This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa huwa لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم
the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is His. Who is He that can intercede with Him but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires Him not, and He is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The UN calls on Israel to stop seizing Palestinian property in the West Bank following the regime's demolition of tents belonging to a Bedouin community. Iran calls for the immediate removal of US sanctions, saying they are hampering efforts to finance the import of medical supplies. Also ahead, the Colombian defense minister says six members of the hit squad that assassinated Haiti's president were retired members of Colombia's military. World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story this hour: the UN chief is deeply concerned by Israel's Wednesday demolition of Palestinian property in a Bedouin community in the occupied West Bank. That's according to a spokesman for Antonio Guterres. The spokesman said the UN chief reiterates his call on Israelis to cease demolitions. Stefan Dujarric said such actions are contrary to international law. They are also undermine chances for the establishment of an independent Palestinian state. He said representatives from the UN and other bodies were unable to provide assistance to the community as Israeli forces denied them access. Dozens of Palestinian Bedouins became homeless after Israeli forces demolished their tents, claiming they were in a military firing range. Rights groups say Israeli demolitions are part of a long-running campaign to make room for new settlements. Jafar Amini is a Palestinian writer and political commentator. He says the United Nations' expression of concern over Israeli crimes is far from enough, and the international community must do more to stop Israel's violations of UN resolutions.
Israel is in violation of tens of resolutions passed by the UN General Assembly. What did the UN do? Nothing. Israel is in violation of many a Security Council resolution because of the veto of America. What did the UN do? Nothing. Instead of words and condemnations and shaking of the head, they could do one simple thing: apply some sanction on the apartheid regime. Why they sanction Iran at the drop of a hat? Why do they sanction Syria at the drop of a hat? Why do they sanction Venezuela at the drop of a hat? Because America asked them to do so, and they have to obey. I have no time for the UN or for their words of condemnation.
Syria says the Global Chemical Weapons Watchdog has turned into a tool to exert pressure on the country and direct false accusations against it. The organizations for of the organization, the actions rather, of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons contradict the principles of impartiality. That's what the chairwoman of the Syrian mission to the OPCW said. Rania Al-Rafai said the U.S. has the largest chemical arsenal in the world, but it is not destroyed despite posing threats to global peace and security. She says Syria joined the Chemical Weapons Convention in 2013 and has fulfilled its obligations ever since. Al-Rafai was addressing an OPCW meeting. The U.S., France, and Britain have long accused Syria of using chemical weapons against its people. Iran's ambassador to the United Nations says the U.S. sanctions against Tehran are hampering efforts to import medical supplies and devices. Majid Safdarabanchi described the U.S. measures as crimes against humanity and war crimes. The Iranian ambassador called for the removal of sanctions, adding that the harmful knock-on effects of U.S. measures affect all people, including women and children. Although the United States has exempted the imports of humanitarian items from its sanctions regime, broad U.S. measures have constrained Iran's ability to finance such humanitarian imports. Tehran has time and again reiterated that the U.S. pressures run counter to international rules. Political commentator Cheryl Labash says the U.S. sanctions against Iran are illegal and are designed to hurt the people.
Anyone who looks into this clearly understands that sanctions hurt the people. They don't hurt institutions, they hurt the people, and that's what it's designed to do. It's illegal, according to the United Nations, for unilateral economic warfare to be perpetrated against independent countries like Iran. These economic measures are hidden because the United States uses its economic power and its domination of the global economy through the dollar to really enforce all these different levels of sanctions, of economic blockade and economic war.
U.S. President Joe Biden says the U.S. military's mission in Afghanistan has achieved its goals.
The United States did what we went to do in Afghanistan, to get the terrorists who attacked us on 9/11 and deliver justice to Osama bin Laden, and to degrade the terrorist threat to keep Afghanistan from becoming a base from which attacks could be continued against the United States. We achieved those objectives. That's why we went.
Biden announced that the U.S. military mission, nearly 20 years after it began, would end on August 31st. He said Washington now needs to meet other threats in the world without elaborating on the nature or place of those threats. The U.S. president said he was confident the Afghan armed forces could stand up to the Taliban, who have made strong advances across the country since the beginning of the year. He also rejected comparisons between the end of the Vietnam War and the conclusion of the war in Afghanistan. The U.S. invaded Afghanistan in 2001 to remove the Taliban from power. Washington accused the group of harboring al-Qaeda terrorists, whom it blamed for the September 11 attacks. Political commentator Scott Bennett says that the U.S. war in Afghanistan has been based on 20 years of lies.
It sickens me tremendously when I hear these pathological liars continuing to spit out these scripts of how America rose up to a great challenge of terrorism and rid the world of a problem and has achieved great results and is leaving with honor. It really offends me deeply as a former Army officer myself, who was part of the military apparatus and looked into all of this, and I tried to win the war and get us out. But ultimately, the Afghanistan war has been built on 20 years of lies, with the epicenter of the lies in the 9/11 attacks, which had nothing to do with Osama bin Laden or the Taliban, a Osama bin Laden was a CIA asset named Tim Osman. Osama bin Laden died of kidney disease in a hospital. He was nowhere near Afghanistan. This was a misadventure based on lies to the American people.
The Afghan government says all regional countries face a common threat, mainly coming from terrorism in Afghanistan, adding that the regional stability can be achieved only through collective efforts to create peace in the war-torn country. Amin Alami reports from Kabul.
Following the start of withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan, the Afghan government believes that the time has arrived for regional players to find a way out of the ongoing crisis for Afghanistan. According to this top Afghan diplomat, the Afghan crisis serves as a shared source of concern for the entire regional states. He says the solution comes only from close cooperation between all regional countries.
The security situation in Afghanistan and its potential repercussions for the region and beyond remains a cause for deep concern. We are faced with a different reality today that threatens our shared vision for a peaceful, prosperous, connected, an economically integrated region. This is a sad reality that can plunge our region into deep crisis if not addressed with collective reckoning and approach.
Their statements come as Iran recently hosted an intra-Afghan dialogue in Tehran in which the country's foreign minister highlighted Tehran's strong commitments to continue supporting Afghanistan, especially in terms of politics, security and economy. Meanwhile, Iranian ambassador to Kabul said that Tehran has always backed the post-Taliban government in Afghanistan to lead the country to lasting peace and stability.
We are determined to boost our mutual ties with Afghanistan and even change this country into a hub connecting regional countries together. Bringing peace and stability in Afghanistan is in line with the interests of all regional states, and if such a goal is achieved, countries like Iran and the whole region would be the real winners.
The expansion of the Taliban attacks has prompted locals to form public uprising military forces against the militant group. And now, it's expected that more lands and cities turn into battlegrounds across the war-ravaged country. Despite this, almost nobody among locals support war. They believe returning to the intra-Afghan negotiating table with a commitment to political solution is the only option for all conflicting aides.
The Taliban have increased their attacks in Afghanistan since May. They have captured dozens of rural districts, mainly in strategic parts of northern Afghanistan. In the meantime, militants say they will offer a written peace proposal to the Afghan government within a month. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Turning to other news now, Haitian police say they have identified 28 people in connection with the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse. According to the police, 26 of the suspects are Colombian. Two others are Haitian-American. 17 of the suspects have already been arrested. The rest, all Colombian, remain at large. The Colombian Defense Ministry says initial findings suggest that several of the attackers have been retired members of the Colombian military.
Following the assassination of the Haitian president, Jovenel Moïse, Interpol officially requested information from the Colombian government and from our national police regarding the alleged suspects for this act. Initial information suggests that they are Colombian citizens, retired members of the National Army. We, the national government, our police and army, have given instructions for the immediate collaboration in the development of the investigation into the clarification of this act.
Taiwan has also announced that 11 suspects in Moïse's assassination were arrested in its embassy in the Haitian capital, Port-au-Prince. The diplomatic mission says the suspects broke into the building on Friday, prompting the security personnel there to notify the police. President Moïse, 53 years old, was assassinated at his home on Wednesday. Lawmakers have called his killing a hideous crime and a tremendous coup on democracy.
Haiti, the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, has again grabbed headlines worldwide. The country, known for its recurrent natural disasters, this time shocked the world with the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse. Moïse, 53, was shot dead early on Wednesday at his private home on the outskirts of the capital, Port-au-Prince, by a group of assailants. Haitian officials later said that the police and the army had managed to track down the suspects. Hours later,
They announced the killing of four suspects and apprehending of two others, as well as freeing three police officers that the assailants had taken hostage. Still, the identity of those involved in Moise's assassination remained unknown. A journalist says a foreign country could be behind a plot to assassinate the Haitian head of state.
This looks like an operation which was funded either by a foreign government or by a very large mafia, whether that mafia was foreign or whether it was a combine of the U.S. of the Haitian bourgeois families, many of whom were against Jovenel because he had taken back some of the perks they had in the past.
Moise's death has, however, caused confusion about who is the legitimate person to lead the country of 11 million people. The current state of affairs does not look good for a nation that has struggled to achieve stability after the fall of the Duvalier dynastic dictatorship in 1986 and witnessed a series of coups and foreign interventions in the recent past. Acting Prime Minister Claude Joseph was the first to denounce Moise's killing as inhumane and barbaric. He later declared a state of siege and granted executives more powers to take the security situation under control. He also appealed to foreign governments for support, saying he doesn't want the nation to plunge into chaos. However, Moise had just this week appointed a new prime minister, Ariel Henry, to take over for Joseph, although he had yet to be sworn in. Now, Henry says he doesn't consider Joseph the legitimate premier anymore. Rather, he should revert to the role of foreign minister. The Caribbean nation has witnessed a wave of politically linked violence in recent years. That's apart from natural disasters, including the 2010 devastating earthquake. The country is still struggling to recover. There are fears that the assassination of the head of state could push the country deeper into chaos amidst deep political divisions, hunger, and gang-related violence.
Elsewhere, officials in the Australian city of Sydney have urged residents to stay at home to help contain a new surging outbreak of COVID there. New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian said they're facing the biggest challenge since the pandemic started. She said restrictions will likely be extended further unless case numbers dramatically drop. On Friday, the southeastern state reported 44 locally transmitted COVID infections. That's the highest daily case count there this year. A two-week lockdown has already been extended into a third week, ending July 16. The lockdown limits public gatherings in Sydney to two people. Residents are also limited to within 10 kilometres of their home. A new poll shows Brazilian people's disapproval rating of the country's president has reached an all-time high. According to the latest survey, 52% of Brazilians rate the government's performance bad or terrible. That's up from 50% in June. It's also the highest since Bolsonaro took office in January 2019. Moreover, 50% of participants expect this trend to continue for the remainder of the president's term. Bolsonaro's administration has been under fire over its handling of the coronavirus pandemic, as well as corruption allegations involving the purchase of COVID-19 vaccines. On Saturday, Brazilians took to the streets demanding the impeachment of the president and more vaccines to fight the coronavirus pandemic. Brazil faces the world's second deadliest outbreak after the United States.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The news from the South American country of Chile that an indigenous woman has been elected to a new assembly charged with drafting the national constitution is a step in the right direction after centuries of oppression of the Mapuche people by the ruling elite of Spanish ancestry. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Cajon International. This article is published under the heading, The Awakening of the Chilean People. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The news from the South American country of Chile that an indigenous woman has been elected to a new assembly charged with the drafting of the national constitution is a step in the right direction after centuries of oppression of the Mapuche people by the ruling elite of Spanish ancestry. Elisa Loncon, a 58-year-old Santiago University professor and activist of the Amerindian movement for the Mapuche people's educational and linguistic rights, will draft a new text to replace Chile's current constitution, which is a product of 17-year reign of terror of General Augusto Pinochet, a CIA agent who overthrew the elected government of Salvador Allende in 1973. As a matter of fact, memories of Pinochet continue to haunt most Chilean people who remember tens of thousands of citizens disappeared and decimated on U.S. orders. Even after his exit from the political scene, Pinochet, who was protected by the American and Zionist spy agencies, continued to indirectly wield power over the hapless people of Chile through proxies serving as chief executives. The current head of state, President Sebastián Piñera, is also viewed by the Chilean people as a U.S. stooge, and it remains to be seen whether he would allow Elisa Loncon to draft a fair and all-representative constitution acceptable to the majority of citizens. According to the latest figures, Amerindians make up almost 40% of the Chilean population, while power rests in the hands of the white people of Spanish stock, who reportedly account for 55% of all citizens. Mapuche people had bravely resisted the invasion of their land in the 16th century by the Spanish and even inflicted several defeats on the European invaders until firepower subdued the lightly armed defenders who had only bows and arrows. Chile gained independence from direct rule from Spain in 1817 because of the liberation campaign launched in southern parts of South America by the Argentinian commander, José dos San Martín. Unfortunately, Chile soon found itself trapped in U.S. hegemony.
which is the main reason for the current widespread political and economic corruption. The Chilean people resent U.S. domination as well as the intrusion of the Israelis to plunder their country. It is worth recalling that a couple of years ago, in the wake of victories in the West for the movement known as BDS, or Boycott, Divest, Sanctions Movement against the Israeli regime, Valdivia in southern Chile became the first city in all of Latin America to officially join the boycott against the Zionist regime for its apartheid policies, military occupation of the West Bank, and illegal blockade of the Gaza Strip. The measure adopted by Valdivia specifically declares the municipality as an apartheid-free zone and prohibits the city from working with any business that is linked to the Zionist entity. The local BDS campaign that helped prompt Valdivia's government to adopt the boycott was led by the Juventud Chileno Arabi por Palestina do Valdivia, JCAPV, which is comprised mostly of university students attending Austral University of Chile. Several politicians, including some members of the Chilean Senate, were also involved in the campaign. In view of these developments, it is hoped that the indigenous people, as well as the conscious white people of European ancestry, will facilitate the work of Elisa Lancan to draft a fair constitution acceptable to the majority of the Chilean people.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing, who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, Make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive. And make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Lebanon's economic and financial crisis could rank as one of the three most severe the world has seen since the mid-19th century. The public are accusing Lebanon's authorities of deliberately failing to mount an adequate policy response to the country's worsening economic and financial crisis. Lebanon's descent into what could end up being one of the top three worst crises in 150 years has been stunningly swift. The country's gross domestic product GDP, which measures the total output of goods and services, nosedived from close to $55 billion in 2018 to an estimated $33 billion last year, as per the latest Lebanon Economic Monitor released by the World Bank last week. The inaction by Lebanese authorities is not due to lack of knowledge or quality advice, but rather the failure to agree on effective policy initiatives and a political consensus that defends a bankrupt economic system, which, by the way, benefited a few for so long. The crisis has caused a grave social fallout that has pushed more than half of the population below the poverty line. The decimated purchasing power of the Lebanese pound has led to more than 40% of households reporting challenges in accessing food and other basic needs. Meanwhile, the nation's unemployment rate spiked from 28% in February 2020 to nearly 40% by the end of the same year. Such dire socioeconomic conditions risk systematic national fallings with regional and potentially global consequences. Propelled by popular desperation and anger, impulsive protests now mark the advent of a longer period of unrest, chaos, and even a social explosion across the country as conditions continue to deteriorate.
Lebanon is suffering from poor governance and a gaping lack of public accountability. To date, the country's three overlapping crises, a financial meltdown, the catastrophic Beirut port explosion, and the COVID-19 pandemic, have not been met with an effective government response. On the contrary, years of government corruption and incompetence laid the ground for Lebanon's accelerating collapse. Many observers have become habituated to Lebanon's dysfunction and perpetual sense of crisis, but Lebanon's current predicament marks a real departure from the past. Even in the worst days of the civil war, while lacking a government, Lebanese found informal ways to keep the country somewhat functioning. This time, it's a different Lebanon. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Crisis hit Lebanon over the weekend, teetered on the verge of complete chaos driven by the Lebanese pound's dramatic nosedive against the dollar that sent agitated Lebanese to the streets across the country, blocking highways with burning tires in Beirut and other areas, and attacking public utilities to protest the deteriorating economic conditions. Now, this coincided with the breakdown of public services that has left the country in total darkness, and with closed gas stations as a result of severe fuel, gasoline, and diesel shortages that have threatened to bring a complete halt to private generators on which the majority of the Lebanese public and businesses, including hospitals, depend for electricity. Now, to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Mohsen Saleh, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Saleh. Now, the collapsing Lebanese pound, which sank to a record low for the first time in Lebanon's history, trading at almost 18,000 Lebanese lira to the U.S. dollar on the black market, coincided with the breakdown of the public services, as we just said, especially electricity, because there is no fuel to power the generators. No securing basic public services by any authority is like basically saying, we want chaos, go ahead and bring about the chaos to the country. Who benefits from all of this in Lebanon right now?
Hi to you, thank you for having me. As we know, everybody knows in Lebanon, and probably, most probably the Europeans, who really were the patronizing of the Lebanese political situation from the 90s with Rafiq Hariri, the martyr of Lebanon. And we know the situation in Lebanon is very miserable, it's going to abyss, and nobody would really have a kind of relief for what's going on. There are some thieves in Lebanon, especially in the political class, with their manager of this partnership between the capitalists, the bank owners, and some of the mafias of the sects in Lebanon, who are leading this country into this abyss. I'm not surprised of this collapse of the Lebanese pound. I'm really anxious about the future of Lebanon after this very critical situation. The situation is not only economic situation, it's a political situation. The Americans and the Europeans, especially the French, now talking about a new mandate for Lebanon because of the political change in the region. Now we have many choices probably. First of all, we have to get rid, to reconstruct Lebanon, to get rid of all these mafias and the bank owners and this system, this capitalist or this new liberal system. Would the Americans agree? Of course not. They are not eager to see solutions in Lebanon. They are not eager to see Lebanese are satisfied with their authorities. There are no actual authorities to authorize good things or to lead the state into a safe place. Actually, I'm really hesitant to say that all these people who are the solution in their hand are the thieves of the money of the country.
Dr. Well, billions. Saleh, this brings us to that worse still. Lebanon was quickly sliding into political abyss, into risk of instability, into social unrest. The top leaders even failed to agree on forming a cabinet, a new government, to at least rescue what's left in the country's economy. Can you explain to us the dilemma that led to the state of political deadlock in Lebanon?
Well, really, really, people, the Lebanese people, they have unveiled all these ambiguities and the Lebanese situation, and now they know that these people who are leading, or what so-called leaders in Lebanon, are not deserving this place or post or position, because they have stolen all the money of the Lebanese. And that's why I guess the Lebanese have the right to raise their voice and go into demonstration, or saying that we have no confidence, no trust whatsoever in this class. And the problem is that all these people were protected by the Americans and the French, and most of them, they have connections with the American embassy and with the Saudis. Now the Saudis raise their hand and say, well, we don't want Hariri, because they said they really said we have paid a lot of money for some of them. Well, most of them, they counted from Jaja to Hariri and others. Well, not to say about other people, because these people are really leading the situation in Lebanon into this catastrophe. And they, of course, they can't make or shape or form any new government that would lead to a solution in Lebanon and relieve people.
Well,
because
in the media,
they are the problem. Because
they are the problem.
How could
it's being shaped otherwise in the media? How is it being shaped in the internal and also the foreign media? It's being shown that there is a dilemma, there is a problem, a bickering problem between the President Aoun and the Premier-designate Saad al-Hariri, who, by the way, has been designated since October 22, 2020. Now, there are trading accusations. Each one is just pointing to the other being of blame. And one wants to form a cabinet of non-partisan specialists to enact reforms and salvage the country from an all-out economic collapse, while the other seemingly wants to secure what is called in the media the Christian rights. What's the main reason for this statement? If Hariri actually has internal and external support, then what does President Aoun want?
Let's say it frankly, for once and for all. President Aoun came to the presidency in order to reform and make some ameliorations to the system, and he could not, because this mafia in these authorities, in the state, they have prevented and blocked any kind of reformation, because they have taken the money of the country. They have stolen the money of the country. How could they help General Aoun, President Aoun, in order to reform? That's the problem, I guess, because also with the political reasoning that would say General Aoun really stood by the resistance in Lebanon, and he did not do what the French and the Saudis want to do in Syria. All this, they are punishing these people, the environment, the embracive environment of the resistance in Lebanon. And I guess this is a kind of conspiracy. Mm-hmm. What would they do in the future in order to solve the situation, because their men are really the problem? Would they agree, the French, and they are putting now some sanctions on their men? Would that solve the situation?
Well,
I really don't know.
One more minute in this segment, Dr. Saleh, but the pound has lost more than 90% of its value, and the basic items have skyrocketed in prices. Do you think that we are looking at the biggest social and economic catastrophe, actually, in West Asia, or is there still time to salvage something?
Well, we are in turmoil. I guess the Americans want to see this kind of turmoil in Lebanon and in Syria and in Iraq and other places, also in Yemen. They are really putting sanctions in order to to these countries, to these states, to collapse.
Seems they
to
are
collapse.
Succeeding, though.
They are. I guess the peoples of the West Asian countries, they can rebuild and reconstruct these countries because they are the heritage of the Americans and the French. We have one choice only: to get rid of these peoples of between brackets, the Americans and the French and the Saudis. And mm-hmm. without kicking out these people from the decision maker of in Lebanon and in other places in Iraq or in Yemen, the Hadi and his gangs, I guess without that we can't rebuild mm-hmm. these countries and the region. And we are really peoples are trying resisting all this kind of hegemony from the 20th century till now. Peoples are going in the right track.
Hopefully so. Thank you very much from Beirut, Dr. Mohsen Saleh, political commentator, for being with us to talk about the economic and social collapse in Lebanon. Please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about Yemen.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The Yemeni armed forces announced earlier last week a military operation targeting Saudi forces, where days after the announcement, the Yemeni military media broadcasted scenes from the operation of the Yemeni armed forces targeting this camp of the Saudi coalition with dozens of Qassam 2K drones in the Al-Wadi'a border area. Now, spokesperson Brigadier General Yahya Al-Sariya announced the killing of a number of Saudi officers and the killing of more than 60 fighters in the ranks of the Saudi coalition aggression. In this large-scale military operation, more in this following report.
Clashes intensified during the past week between the Yemeni armed forces and forces loyal to the outgoing President Abdrabbu Mansour Hadi within the Rahwan district, the second largest district of Ma'rib Governorate, which extends from northwest to west. This came in the wake of Hadi's forces violating a tribal truce signed in earlier March 2020 between Sana'a forces and some of the leaders of the Rahwan tribes, which stipulated the commitment of the army and popular committees not to attack the district's areas that had been neutralized from the ongoing confrontations. Under the agreement signed by the Marwan and the Shadawda tribes, the largest of the Rahwan tribes, which held for more than a year before Hadi forces violated it, Sana'a granted the people of the district the right to protect and manage their own security. However, the transformation of a number of areas of Rahwan district into a launching pad for the operations of Hadi forces and the Islah Party militias had little effect on the course of the confrontations on the western and southwestern fronts, where the skirmishes declined in the past 2 days. Meanwhile, the Yemeni armed forces were able to make new military progress west of the Khanjar camp, specifically in the Khub and Al-Shaga front of Al-Jawf Governorate. The military media center in Sana'a published audio and video documented scenes that showed the army and the popular committees in the area, in addition to showing scores of dead and injured Saudi mercenaries. In the meantime, the spokesman for the Yemeni Armed Forces, Brigadier General Yahya Sariya, confirmed that the drone air force was able to carry out a massive military operation targeting a training camp of the Saudi Emirati coalition in the Al-Wadi'a area, with 10 Qassam 2K drones targeting the command center, training sites, and sectors. Sariya pointed out that the operation, which was documented by video and audio, led to the killing of a Saudi officer and 60 members of Saudi mercenaries, including a number of military leaders. According to military sources in Sana'a, the targeted camp is under the supervision of the Central Military Command in the region and enjoys high protection and advanced technological security via American satellites. Syria made it clear that targeting Al-Wadi'a camp was a message to Washington that will be followed by other messages during the upcoming period of fighting to liberate all of Maghreb.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Sydney is author and academic Dr. Tim Anderson. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Anderson. Now, footage of the Yemeni Armed Forces media showed Yemeni Qasif 2K arriving at the scene inside the Al-Wadi'a military camp, which is a very, very important camp on the border with Yemen, while Saudi soldiers and their mercenaries were fleeing. Whoever was left of them fled for their lives. Now, the Yemeni Armed Forces have been targeting Saudi military bases for a long time now. Why was this operation very significant for the Yemeni Armed Forces?
It's another step, really, in the Yemeni forces taking over parts of Najran, moving into area that has been disputed for a long time, but in any case, currently Saudi territory. So there's strong support they have also from some of the people there. So, and the use of the drones that you mentioned, as you said, has been used before against other Saudi military bases.
Well, during the same week, Yemeni army forces launched two missile strikes against the position of Saudi-led militants in Yemen's very strategic central province of Ma'rib, which is witnessing right now huge operations. They killed and wounded dozens of those mercenaries. Many reason might be behind the choice to take the time to liberate Ma'rib, because it's been over 5 months now that the operation of Ma'rib had started. However, if you want to break down the situation in this major city, which is bordering Saudi Arabia, why do you think that the Yemeni armed forces led by the resistance forces of Ansarullah are taking their time to liberate Ma'rib?
I don't think it's completely correct to say that they're taking their time. They've actually made a number of statements to say that we're going to, you know, move very quickly, and they wanted to move very quickly. But as you say, it's an extremely heavy battle, and it's the biggest stakes in the north of Yemen, really, because this is the one base that the Hadi so-called government based in Riyadh has. In other words, everything that the Saudis have been doing has been trying to reinforce this one significant base on the ground. And if and when Ansarullah-led forces take Ma'rib, that is going to change the complexion in the entire region, basically. And as you say, there's been heavy battle, but there's been a lot of airstrikes on the forces coming in from the west, and the Yemeni revolutionary government is using ballistic missiles also against their targets there. I've read that there's been thousands of casualties there, so I don't think their aim is to slow it down. In fact, they are making some moves in other parts of the country at the same time, but this is really the big battle in the north of Yemen.
Mm-hmm. Well, one very interesting thing happened last week was the breaking of an agreement that happened between the Yemeni armed forces and the biggest tribes of Ma'rib, because the mercenaries of Saudi Arabia broke that agreement and started shooting from those specific areas after long talks happened between Ansarullah and these tribes, and they all agreed that they should not fight. Do you think that Mohammed bin Salman is now trying to maneuver something new to maybe bring new enemies for Ansarullah to the table?
Well, there's always the aim to try and divide and carve out sections of the country. I mean, you know, that Hadi himself was the one who was trying to move back to a six-part partition of the country under Saudi direction. So they'll keep doing that. But I think there's a measure of desperation coming from Riyadh now, because they are losing on so many fronts. And the revolutionary government is making incursions into the south now at the same time. So they are fighting on more than one front.
Well, the Swedish foreign minister landed in Riyadh last week, where she met with Saudi foreign minister Faisal bin Farhan, and for God knows what reason, she met with Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi, the ousted Yemeni president. Now, she tweeted that the discussions were concerning the peace efforts in Yemen for bilateral issues and for humanitarian issues as well, and humanitarian rights. Now, Saudi Arabia is still bombing Yemen. It's blockading the country, aerial, sea, land blockades, and it's sending even more mercenaries to occupy the country. What peace efforts is she talking about?
Well, the problem is that there is a very bad Security Council resolution, I think it's 2216 from 2015, which frames the whole conflict as though what they call the Houthis are the problem, basically an outside problem, and somehow enshrines Hadi as legitimate president of Yemen. Now, Hadi had a interim role in 2012 through to 2014, but somehow this Security Council resolution from 2015 has enshrined forever the role of this exile junta in Riyadh as the legitimate government. And so the language being used, and you see it in the Persian Gulf press and the Western press, the Yemeni government this, the Yemeni government that, they're talking about a regime, or not even a regime, but a group of people in Riyadh, basically, as the Yemeni government. So when other agents, including those, you know, looking at the UN security resolution, come in, there's a very difficult structure there to deal with. And you know, what Ansar al-Adad revolutionary government has said, that they'll agree to a ceasefire if the blockade is lifted, unfortunately is undermined by this very bad Security Council resolution from 6 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, Oman has been long perceived as a neutral party in the part of West Asia, and has spent the past few weeks attempting to get Saudi Arabia and Yemen to the negotiating table to find an end to the ongoing suffering of the Yemeni people. Now, the Yemeni conditions for any ceasefire, just like you just mentioned, are fixed. They are not negotiable. Ansarullah said it clearly by the movement's leader, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi. He said, lift the siege, halt all forms of aggression, just stop bombing the same place hundreds of times, and end the occupation. I think that these are reasonable. Even if I want to stand by the Yemenis, if I want to look, I want to take a different position and be objective about it, they seem very logical conditions there. What is the next move for Yemen in the event that Mohammed bin Salman just chooses to move forward with the aggression instead of accepting the reality and just giving up on his psychopathic warmongering policies?
It's very difficult. He's in a very difficult situation. Let's say the Saudi rulers are in a very difficult situation because they are losing on several fronts. They're having their own territory incursions into what they consider their own territory, as well as about to lose Marib, which is going to be a very big blow to them. And of course, the Emirates and Israel are in the south, you know, and there's some some movement going on there, let's say, in favor of the revolutionary government. So the Saudis have been suing for peace for some time because they know that they're losing, but they're hanging on to those shreds of so-called legitimacy that the UN gives them, and that their Western backers are hanging on to, really. So, but nevertheless, the Saudis know that they're losing. They've gone to Iran, they've gone to Oman, they're doing talks, they're looking for peace. And in the meantime, as you say, the revolutionary government has put a very reasonable position, and while that's not met, they are simply going ahead with what they're going ahead with, and they're making more progress, basically. And this is, you know, the problem is the legitimacy battle going on internationally is going to try and sheet home responsibility to, you know, their favoured party. And so that's the dilemma in terms of the international debate.
Well, it seems that we are looking ahead to very decisive weeks ahead in liberating Ma'arib and see where things go for the action negotiations to move forward. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Tim Anderson, author and academic, for joining us from Sydney to talk about the latest developments in Yemen. Thank you for being with us. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
The limelight.
Recent studies suggest that Canada Revenue Agency has been singling out Muslim charities for review. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Faisal Qati, writer. This article is published under the heading Islamophobia: Why is Canada unfairly targeting Muslim charities? Stay tuned for more. Islamophobia and targeting of Muslims in Canada have been in the news in the recent weeks, but this has been a daily reality for far too many Muslims for far too long, whether in the guise of national security surveillance, deviations from normal due process, no-fly list inclusion, anti-niqab legislation, and even the targeting of Muslim institutions. From the outpouring of support in the wake of the recent attack in London, Ontario, it would appear that the silent majority of Canadians have only love for all, but they have been fed a lot of misinformation and fear over the years, and we are now seeing the consequences. Certain Canadian politicians and segments of the media shoulder much of the blame for the portrayal of Muslim men as potentially dangerous criminals and Muslim women as imperiled and in need of rescue. This bigotry is rooted in a culture of fear that has been nurtured for decades by many people in positions of power. The Canadian government has played a major role in breeding Islamophobia, and two reports issued this year confirm some of the community's worst fears when it comes to targeting Muslim charities. Some of Canada's 1.5 million Muslims are worried about being unjustly flagged for giving to Muslim charities. Several charities have had to shut down as some institutions have attracted excessive scrutiny. Last month, the National Civil Liberties Coalition, representing dozens of groups, accused